ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 28th of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Firefighters have been working through the night to try and contain out-of-control blazes in Victoria's southwest, where it's believed multiple properties have already been lost. Strong winds have eased, however, one emergency warning is still in place, with thousands evacuated from the area. There's still another 4 days of scorching heat forecast for some parts of the state, following yesterday's blistering temperatures, which saw records tumble around the country. Annie Guest reports.
Like the other Victorians who've had to evacuate their bushfire-threatened homes, Carola Anstis is full of anxiety.
I just worry that sparks could still get to the house, so I don't think we're out of danger with the house, personally, so I worry about that.
Carola Anstis already knows trees are blackened and brown on her 135-acre place next to the Otway National Park, where she runs the Carlisle River Wildlife Shelter.
I don't know what's happening down there now.
What's that like to not know?
I can't even describe how we feel, really. It's just devastating. And it's more, for me, it's the wildlife, because we can rebuild. It'll take us time.
What do you think the likelihood is of those animals that you'd rescued that were on your place surviving?
I don't think they have, except for maybe one or two. And we are just losing so much wildlife with all of these fires everywhere.
Authorities fear several properties have been burnt in the out-of-control blaze that's destroyed about 10,000 hectares of bushland in the Otways. Fires also continue to burn near Corryong in Victoria's northeast and 300 kilometres south around the Alpine National Park. Hot conditions continue today after the mercury hit 48.9 degrees in the northwest Victorian town of Walpiup yesterday, becoming the state's hottest temperature on record. It kept local resident Will inside playing table tennis.
I'm looking out the window into the paddock and it's like almost like a barbecue. It's simmering across the top.
But for machinery dealer Doug Jackson, it was just a summer day.
Doesn't feel that hot. Doesn't feel too bad.
And what does it mean to you that your town has now broken this temperature record?
Well, I suppose we're one up on the rest of the Victoria.
For the Climate Council's CEO, Amanda McKenzie, the scorching conditions are deeply worrying.
Yet again, temperature records are being smashed in southeastern Australia. Many places have reached nearly 50 degrees. This should be a wake-up call to all of us. This is climate change.
So what should policymakers take away from this?
The key driver of climate change is, of course, the burning of coal, oil and gas. So we need to accelerate the transition away from those fuel sources to more renewable energy.
Authorities are bracing for challenging heatwave conditions in South Australia and parts of New South Wales and the ACT today too. The Bureau of Meteorology's Jonathan Howe says despite a cool change sweeping through coastal areas of the country's southeast on Tuesday night, the high winds and lack of rain still creates significant fire risks.
The fire danger ratings also do show high to extreme fire dangers in the south. And that's because we are still seeing some quite gusty winds coming through from the south and with no rainfall expected with this cool change. So we are still expecting to see elevated fire dangers, including across some parts of Victoria.
The Bureau of Meteorology's Jonathan Howe ending Annie Guest's report. After days of protests and outrage over the killing of a young man by immigration officers in the US, President Donald Trump has dramatically changed his language on the issue. It's the second shooting death of an American citizen by federal agents in Minneapolis in the last month, sparking a state legal challenge and even frustration among Republicans. For more on this, ABC's America's editor John Lyons is in Washington. John, 37-year-old intensive care nurse Alex Pretty, was shot dead at the weekend by US immigration officials. What's the latest?
Well, the latest, Isabella, is we're seeing a dramatic change by President Trump. Up until now, he's been very hardline in his rhetoric. He's resisted any investigations, for example, into the fatal shooting of Renee Good 3 weeks ago. However, the shooting of this intensive care nurse, Alex Pretty, is changing things. The mood is changing. President Trump's now under serious pressure with opinion polls on this issue. So he now says he does want an investigation. He wants that to be honest and honourable, to use his words. And he's effectively sacked the man who was overseeing this crackdown by immigration officials in Minneapolis and other parts of the country, Greg Bovino. He's immediately, essentially sent him back to his barracks in California and replaced him with a longtime border public servant, Tom Homan.
John, do you think this marks the beginning of a major change of approach in policy regarding illegal migrants by President Trump?
Americans killing Americans on the streets of America will never be popular here, even with the hardline supporters of the MAGA base, the Make America Great Again base. Now, President Trump's central policy of immigration continues to be popular. The majority of Americans, according to polls and the fact that he was elected on this signature issue, do not want illegal or undocumented migrants to remain in America. However, the imagery of seeing a federal official holding a gun and shooting a man in the back, an intensive care nurse, following only 3 weeks ago from the shooting of the mother of three, that has really caused a great consternation, even amongst Republicans here in America. And so I think we're seeing, in a way, trying to take the hard edges of this, and I think we'll see less confrontations in the streets.
And John, as you said, a softening of position, a changing of language from President Trump. There's been a few of those lately, hasn't there, in the last couple of weeks? The first on seizing Greenland, the second backing away from his comments about NATO, how NATO forces did not serve on the front line in Afghanistan, and now these immigration operations. What do you think is going on?
President Trump is still very powerful. He's an extremely powerful commander-in-chief and president. However, those three losses to which you refer, those three backdowns, he didn't expect the backlash from Europe over the Greenland issue. He did not realise the anger that his comments about NATO forces would cause, particularly from countries like the United Kingdom, which has been ferocious, much stronger than the reaction from countries such as Australia, where mothers of soldiers who died in Afghanistan have been appearing on British television saying, you know, you can't say this about my son. Now this ice crackdown. We may have seen peak Trump. It doesn't mean to say his power is waning, but we may have seen peak Trump to the extent that until now, for the last year, he's been able to do anything. For the first time now, I'm seeing a real vulnerability in the way President Trump's talking and those around him, such as Caroline Levitt.
ABC's America's editor, John Lyons. Later today, Israel will mark the end of a distressing chapter with the funeral of the last Gaza hostage. 24-year-old Ran Gavili's body was retrieved through a major search operation more than 2 years after the October 7 attacks. Now, focus is shifting on how to progress the ceasefire in Gaza. But there are still sticking points, such as conditions demanding Hamas hand over weapons. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
On the side of the road in one of Gaza's many tent camps, a young boy gets his hair cut as other children watch on. There's a sense here that Palestinians are trying as hard as they can to get on with their lives, but uncertainty abounds, fueled by previous broken promises, as 25-year-old Mohammed Abu Al-Khumsan explains.
In the media, we're hearing the news from the US or Israeli administrations from time to time that phase two of the ceasefire has come into effect. But we as residents of Gaza who are living this reality know that these are just words.
Since the ceasefire began in October, Palestinian health authorities have reported more than 480 people have been killed and more than 1,300 injured in Israeli attacks, as Hamas and Israel accused each other of breaching the deal. Mohammed says there's scepticism inside Gaza's high security borders, with Israel still in control of more than half of the strip.
So far, there is no progress. We will begin feeling that we are in phase two once there is reconstruction, an end to the killing, and no daily Israeli violations.
Earlier this month, the White House declared the Gaza truce was moving into its next phase. The Trump administration appointed a new Palestinian technocratic government to take over management of the Strip from Hamas, and the militant group, which is a proscribed terrorist organisation under Australian law, says it is cooperating. Hamas's spokesman is Hazem Qassem.
We confirmed this to the mediators, and there are preparations on the ground for this, and therefore it is clear that Hamas is genuinely interested to hand over the reins of power to this independent committee.
But Qassem says it's premature to talk about Hamas laying down its weapons, a key part of phase two.
This has to be resolved through an internal national agreement, through dialogue between the factions and the mediators, and it cannot be imposed on our Palestinian people. These arms are legitimate.
That indicates Hamas will only consider handing over weapons to the Palestinian government, and that the proposed international stabilization force, pitched as the answer to Gaza's security issues in the near term, won't play a role in that process. Donald Trump has long insisted Hamas would pay a heavy price if it didn't comply, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said as recently as yesterday the disarming of Hamas was the priority of phase two. One thing more likely to happen in coming days is the reopening of the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, the only gateway between the Strip and the world which doesn't go through Israel. 38-year-old Ahmed Jalal says it's highly anticipated.
The Rafah crossing will open and there will be freedom of movement for travel abroad, for the sick and wounded, for those who need treatment abroad.
Israel had said Rafah wouldn't reopen in both directions until the last hostage body was returned, a process which is now complete. A clock which has been counting the days, hours and minutes the Israeli captives had been held in Gaza has been ticking over in central Tel Aviv. Overnight, the clock was stopped at almost 844 days, marking the end of a chapter for the hostages and their families, but the beginning of another for the Palestinian population still in Gaza. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
A Melbourne mother has turned the unthinkable loss of her daughter to overdose into action. She successfully lobbied the federal government to create a national medicines record to help better detect potential medication abuse. Doctors say a national record is long overdue, but warn they'll have to balance patient safety with privacy concerns. National Health reporter Stephanie Darzell has this exclusive report.
Reminders of Alison Collins's late daughter Erin fill the Melbourne home they once shared.
Erin was a young, vibrant, bubbly, happy young person who was trying to find her way in her life. She did have her share of struggles, but she was working on that and she was building her skills.
24-year-old Erin was on medication for mental health issues, carefully controlled by her team of health professionals. But Erin had begun doctor shopping, stockpiling medication from multiple telehealth providers. Less than 6 months ago, Erin died after overdosing on that medication.
The ease of access to prescription medication on these telehealth services was too easy. There needed to be improved safety measures for patients, but also improved safety measures for these health professionals working on these telehealth services so they could see clinical history and current medications for the patient in front of them.
Although the grief is still raw, Alison has turned an inconceivable loss into a rallying cry for action, campaigning for a national alert system so health professionals can detect potential medication abuse. The call has been heard by the highest level of government, with Health Minister Mark Butler promising the federal government will move to force health practitioners to record what drugs they prescribe a patient under a new national medicines record.
I was really impacted by Alison's story and her willingness really to channel what is extraordinary grief into advocacy for a system that's better for people into the future.
The plan is still in its infancy, but the government anticipates the national medicines record would be linked to a patient's MyHealth record. Currently, healthcare providers can access medication history through MyHealth record, but patients can hide or remove specific documents or opt out entirely. There were serious security and privacy concerns during the MyHealth record rollout, and similarly, one of the challenges with creating a national medicines database will be striking the delicate balance between patient safety and privacy. Mr. Butler says a consultation period will consider that and other complexities over the course of this year.
We've got to make sure the record is as useful as possible. It's in real time, it's very user-friendly, but also require medical professionals to consider that information before making important prescribing decisions. It's absolutely critical for protecting patient safety.
Royal Australian College of General Practitioners President Michael Wright says a national medicines record is long overdue.
The best way to get care is through someone who knows you and your history. And if people are seeing multiple providers, there's a risk that information either isn't shared or gets lost, and we can see tragic circumstances happen.
As she grieves her daughter, Alison Collins is taking comfort from the hope her own tragedy could potentially prevent others.
These new reforms give our family peace of mind that Erin's story has been heard and her story is creating change that will save other families going through this same heartbreak.
Alison Collins ending that story by Stephanie Dalzell and Paige Coburn. As we heard earlier in the program, it's been a hot week and Australians have been finding different ways to cope. Many don't have the option to escape to aircon and can put their health at risk simply by going to work. So what rights do workers have in these sweltering temperatures? Isabel Misali reports.
It's peak tourist season in the South Australian town of Morgan. But as temperatures soared, Sue Diamond made the tough decision to close her cafe and lolly shop. She recorded 48 degrees at her business yesterday.
We just couldn't even turn on the toasting machine. It's just far too hot for any of our staff.
It's the third time in a fortnight she's had to do this. She has to weigh up safety along with her income and her casual staff.
If we close and we can't give them another shift because there's only 7 days in the week, they lose out on that. And, you know, it's huge financial cost to them and their families.
Australian Council of Trade Unions President Michelle O'Neill warns it's a hazard that goes beyond this week's heatwave.
This is a massive issue for Australian workers. And with the heatwaves that we're experiencing around Australia at the moment and year upon year increasing temperatures as a result of climate change, it's becoming more of an issue.
She's been pushing for national regulation to protect all workers from extreme heat.
So in some sectors, there's a long history of negotiated temperatures where workers either have to have additional breaks, be moved to a cooler area, be able to slow down their work and to cease work altogether when it gets to a certain temperature. But that's not uniform.
Swinburne University Associate Professor Timothy Bednall explains, under work health and safety laws, employers have a general responsibility to provide a safe workplace. That includes managing the hazard of extreme temperatures.
One way that employers can address problems related to heat is scheduling of work for in times where heat is less likely to be a problem. Another thing is flexibility in terms of location.
Safe Work Australia's advice also includes minimising physical effort requirements and ensuring access to cool water, air conditioning or fans, or access to shade for outdoor work. And if working in a heatwave is necessary, it says employees should be able to self-pace their work. Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys from the University of Technology Sydney says extra breaks are also important, but adds,
Australia is not really on top of this issue. It's my view that we can't rely on the sorts of protocols around heat that we've had in the past because these are unprecedented times.
She leads the Too Hot to Work project at UTS, which partners with councils, think tanks and unions.
You know, some of the workers who end up being quite sick and even dying from high heat are actually young workers, young fit men who are just not used to managing high heat and can't recognise the signs when their body's not coping. So things like training, things like new protocols around at what point work needs to stop, the higher the temperature, yes, but also the higher the humidity, the more of the problem. Humidity stops us sweating and cooling down.
Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys ending that report by Isabel Misali. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is finally trying to temper the ICE crackdown in Minneapolis. But why did he let it go so far in the first place? Today, Claire Finkelstein, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania, on what Trump's really trying to achieve and why the events mirror the lead up to a civil war. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.